Welcome back, listeners. My name is Jackson Vickery, and I'm the host and producer of the JV Club podcast. On this episode, I spoke to costume designer Ellen Mirojnik and production designer Ruth DeJong from Oppenheimer.
Like you two have become fast friends, because while I was researching you guys, it doesn't seem as though you've worked on any other projects before prior to this. Where did you guys meet?
On this. Through Chris Nolan.
Yes, exactly. We became fast friends. I think you know, we are some of the first two to start the entire film. Maybe Chris is meeting with Ludwig about music, and maybe Scott Fisher and Andrew privately, but really Ellen and I are in the office looking at research and beginning conversations with Chris right out of the gate. And Ellen and I were the new kids on the block. So everybody else, Hoyta, Scott, Andrew, they've done like,
they all knew each other.
So many films with Chris, and Ellen and I are like, okay,
we're two girls.
So
I mean, into this family, and
exactly
how are we going to work? It was an immediate, I think it was just immediate, like we'd been there for quite some time. I think privately we went, ooh, we're the new girls on the block. But as soon as we got going, I don't think that there was anything to hold us back.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we had to be fearless, because I think if we came in with any fear or concern that it was our boss was Chris Nolan, we'd
get like axed.
Yes.
But you know, people say that people repeat to us about bringing your A game and et cetera. And I think with Chris, you bring your A+ game, or you bring the game that's going to hit it out of the park. There isn't anything like it in the whole entire world.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. And he allows that space for the best. I mean, he demands it, but in a contrived way. It's all the tools are there for us, and he is right there in the trenches with us. I do not know a director who is more in depth in the prep period and the preparation every single day, all day. And I think we were in the trench. I mean, I think we all got so close because we were in the trenches, in the sense that we had a massive undertaking, 180-page script, a 57-day shoot. Chris, we had been warned, shoots so fast, and he'll get 3 days ahead. He'll get 5 days ahead.
45 years.
And Ellen and I were thinking, how is this going to work?
This going to work?
But yeah, so I think it's just... And we signed up for it. We said yes. So I think we came in knowing.
Once you say yes, I think that you have to be able and ready and able to jump off the building without a second thought about it. And so what Chris, being that Chris is so specific, he's there with you. He is just as much of a participant as you are. It is a collaboration like no other in the entire business, I think. Mm-hmm. And I think that in his being specific, it gives you like a path, and that path could be elaborated on at any given moment, but it gives you a path to know the execution. There's like no second thought. But the most amazing thing about working with Ruth and being the new kids on the block, I think, was our lanes crossed without a question. They always do. Mm-hmm. But the connection was so fine that it didn't require continual communication. We just knew what it was that was required, what we had to do. I knew, I could see by what Ruth was doing, by images and scale models, etc. I could see exactly what she was doing and where she was doing it and how she was doing it. I could ask a four question with three words in it, and I'd get it, and then I would know how to proceed in, you know, in my lane. And I think that I've not experienced that like that. It's so second nature with somebody that I didn't know Ruth before. And it was as if we'd known each other forever and known each other, how you design, how you think, what is important, what do you see, how do you feel, et cetera. All those elements are really, we couldn't get it wrong.
Yeah, definitely. Yes, I think it, you know, there was a shorthand that was established, and through our work, a lot of it was, I think the team as a whole, everybody, all the department heads, to me, I found were very immense self-drive and dedication to the common goal of, regardless of time and budget, any constraints, everybody was committed to executing Chris's vision at the highest level. And that became the commonality between all of us. So if everybody supported everyone, from Scott Fisher supporting art department, or even however we were all, and whatever Ellen needed, it was like, well, what color sofa are you sending to New Jersey for the IAS house? It's like, well, I was going to put so-and-so in this color dress. And then Chris is able to go, wait, well, I don't want her in that dress sitting on, you know, in real time, we were navigating it.
And navigating it really quickly.
Yes.
Because there were two elements that I think made us really like soar in ways that are just supernatural. And that was 57 days, and to shoot in 57 days and not having any money. We didn't have much money. And we had to really use every creative ounce of energy we could use at any given time, thinking on our feet, seeing what's around, not scrimping by any means, but being able to use the money that we had wisely.
We scrimped. I mean, I had Home Depot sheds disguised at,
but you would never know. And I'm not going to tell you which ones they were, because I thought they were fabulous looking. And I didn't know that they were Home Depot sheds till she told me on the day that they were Home Depot sheds.
And I'm not taking credit for that. That was Chris's idea.
Oh.
We were very utilitarian with our funds, and we needed to be. I mean, I think that's the interesting thing, is the success of this film. You know, we often get asked, can you believe how well it's done? Can you believe the money it's made? Can you believe how many people have gone to the theater to see it? And we're like, no, we can't, actually. It's a period film. It's about Oppenheimer with talking heads in rooms for three straight hours. But what we were able to do with that, and on a scale that feels huge, but we didn't have Marvel money at all. We wished we did, but actually I don't wish I do, because I don't think, and Chris and I talk about this, we wouldn't have had the film we had, because you almost become uncreative when you have
too much money.
So you take that away, and then you really have to get creative. And it's like, well, what is your Los Alamos, or what is the costumes? How do you do a scene of this many people that, you know, Oppie is addressing? And I think, that's the core and the essence. I mean, it felt like at times the genre of the film, are we watching a sports? I mean, just the energy and the music and all of the crafts coming together, that synergy is what has somehow magically, you know,
get an infusion from the, it there's an infusion of energy, creativity, and love for what it is that you're creating. I mean, I think that passion does not leave the equation under, yes, we could be utilitarian and so on, but I think if we were not passionate about what our end goal was, we wouldn't be sitting here talking to you today. You know, it's very, important to always hold that. And I think that whether, and I think that Chris was, the interesting thing for me is that Chris wanted to absolutely make an authentic film. There was a 100% reality to it all. However, he wanted it original and inspired and be able to relate to a modern audience. Those are three elements that are not necessarily always part of designing a period film, whether it's production design or costume design. It's those elements, the authentic part is, but married to originality and accessibility to a modern audience in a film that, as Ruth said, is 3 hours of talking heads. there's no part that equals any other part that I just said, but it is from that mass amount of chaos that was in Oppenheimer's brain. It got infused in us, and through that chaos, we had to make magic. That makes sense? He's like, no, not at all. COVID, does that make sense?
But what is so curious that I have to ask you, so there's obvious budget restraints that you've had on past projects, there's timing constraints that you've had on past projects, a number of things that you've dealt with on this particular project that you've had with different projects in the past. But I'm curious, what was something singular for each of you in your two departments that was unlike any challenge that you've had to face in regards to not just timing or budget restraints or anything like that? I'm curious what the challenge for you, but for this particular film.
I think it's for me, it was a combination of elements. It was the challenges are always presented by what the vision of the director is. Okay, so from the director's vision, you will always get a different challenge on each project that you do, I think. And on this film, the challenge for me were a couple of them, meaning that there were tons of actors, tons of extras, many changes, the desire for originality, but authenticity. A very large challenge was said right at the get-go from our leader, and that was no one is to wear hats in this film. And that in a period film is a disruptor, meaning that every period film that you probably ever watched always had men's hats, women's hats, no matter where they were, everybody was always had a hat on their head. This story was not to have one hat. The only hat that this story would have would be on Killian Oppenheimer's head. And so I thought, okay, so this is totally, it's a story taken from, told through Killian's point of view. And in trying to really assess this challenge, I actually really had to picture frame by frame, whatever that was to become in my mind's eye, and know that with hats, if I had had hats and not been asked to not have them, would it be a distraction? And my answer was yes, it would be a distraction in the frame if all of those people were hatted throughout the film, men, women. And it allowed us in turn to make this be a messier film in a really good way. I say messy, meaning it was organic. It felt real. It did feel organic, original. And it wasn't a challenge, however, in the end, to follow the story through different periods of time. Does that make sense?
Absolutely.
Yeah. No, and I think it was Chris's vision for the singularity of just Oppenheimer wearing the hat, the iconic, making him iconic essentially, and because of the period of the time is men wore hats. But I think that was just a strong, bold choice. And then for Ellen to arrive there, it's hard because I had a similar situation both with Los Alamos, understanding what the actual town looked like and was, and the scale and the size. And it was huge and it was massive. And the US government gave them $2 billion. That was in 1941, $2 billion to build Los Alamos, gave it to Oppie and was like, build your town. It's like, and gave him 3 years. I didn't have either. So there was that.
That was a dream. That was in a really a fever dream.
Chris, you know, was like, look, you need to divorce yourself from the research. You need to take the essence of the research. And together, that's how Chris and I found and discovered what the town you see that we rose up from the earth at our chosen Los Alamos location. So we actually shot on location along the same mountain range, just a couple hours as the crow flies, maybe 45 minutes, but a couple hours away. And then he got his epic cinematic vistas, north, south, east, west. And that was our own private backlot, uninterrupted, uninhabited, could do whatever we want. We had initially planned on shooting there for 2 weeks, but we ended up shooting there for 6 days because then we moved up to the actual Los Alamos and budgetarily were able to utilize all of the interiors and cross-cut them with the exteriors at our actual ghost ranch. So it was just that sort of efficiency and thinking outside of the box. But I would say my biggest challenge of the entire movie was building the White House, not because the White House is the Oval Office, the cabinet room, the lobby, not because it's difficult to build, but we had not planned on ever building it. We had a location selected, the Nixon Library in Yorba Linda, and that location fell through at the 11th hour, unbeknownst to all of us. Went to set that morning. We were shooting Kitty and Oppie's house in Pasadena. It was their Berkeley house before they had moved to Los Alamos. And I called Tom Hayslip, our executive producer, and said, we have a problem. He goes, we have a huge problem. And he goes, but I think Emma let me know that Gary Oldman is booked, which you probably already knew that. Mm-hmm. Truman is shooting on this date. That was 7 days from this day. This day had already started. So that means tomorrow is 6 days from the day that we shoot the White House. I don't have a stage. I don't have a set. I don't have an Oval Office. Mm-hmm. I called my supervising art director. She said, I think I put one on hold like 4 months ago when we were deciding what we were going to do. And I don't think I ever took it off hold. She hadn't. It was the Veep set, which was a full scale actual replica of the Oval Office that we then pulled out of. It was flat packed, pulled it out. It was a mess. The molding was, it was a mess. I really truly, and initially they told us, oh, it's going to take like four or five days to pull it out. I said, no, we need it now. I'll send my carpenters over. We have to pull it out. It has to come. We secured a stage. And we had from then on 4 days to finish the Oval Office and the lobby and the cabinet room. The paint, I remember Emma coming to set. She goes, oh, it smells of paint. I said, oh, don't touch the walls. They're all wet. It worked. That was like the third thing we shot that day. But Chris, matter of factly, when I went to the Berkeley house, I don't know if, were you there?
What, and
when I told, so he
I did, I was somewhere because the energy did change on this, at this moment in time, the energy got a little tense and everybody was a bit concerned and really concerned for Ruth.
And it's concerning.
It was very concerning because yes, Mr. Oldman was going to shoot on April the 14th or 15th. That's, I forget the date, but I do remember that. And if I could have taken a hammer and brought something to help her build something, I would have. But it was tense for a moment. I think that kind of tension, I think, normally happens with other people.
Yeah.
It doesn't normally happen with us, but Ruth is a genius and knew how to solve it. I mean, and it worked out perfectly, seamlessly, I might add.
It was good. We ran a crew for 24 hours a day for 5 days, and it happened. So it wasn't even me. I just paced in there.
Her pacing really paid off. It really, it was magnificent set that she put together in no time.
But it was, so that was our biggest challenge in the art department, just getting thrown that curveball. Otherwise it was all a challenge, I think, you know, but I think that was
out of the blue.
Yeah. So it was like, oh man, but we did it. We're still standing today talking to you. So, yeah.
And I'm curious what you take from Oppenheimer himself, and maybe this is prior to shooting and then post shooting this film, and maybe in the months sort of to follow this film's release. I'm curious, what do you take from the man prior to shooting this project and post shooting this project?
What do you mean, the man, like Chris, or you
oh,
mean
no, Oppenheimer,
the character, yeah, of the real person Oppenheimer.
Mm-hmm. But, like, what you mean, how do I think about it? Yeah, I guess I don't quite understand the question. Like, how do I perceive the person of Oppenheimer, or who Oppenheimer was, or
yeah, sort of, yes, I would say sort of in the essence of, like, what was something that maybe surprised you sort of pre the film shoot, and then post the film shoot, what surprised you maybe even more?
That's a good question.
It's a good question. I don't know I would think about it.
I think if anything, it was perplexing to understand someone with such, he is on a level of intelligence that I am not. So to be thinking about splitting atoms in his dreams and understanding this entirely other world that I think getting to know him through
his story,
but he was also a bit of a walking contradiction too, because he had a huge ego. And I think it was, for me, it was just learning deeper and deeper about his character and who he was. And it was a fascinating experience. I don't know that then post the film, anything changed for me. I think it was just that
it was reinforced.
And I think seeing the film for the very first time, because when we're making the film, I am not emotionally there. It's about a task. It's about a mission every day with my work. And so I'm not in those moments as they're filming the scenes and saying the lines. I'm not really taking that in. And then to see the film in its full form and to see the character of Oppenheimer and who he is and was, and how it was just fascinating. And I was at a loss of words at the end of the film, because it was deeply emotional. You see this very complex person, mm-hmm, that you wanted him to win it all. I wanted to root for Oppie, and I wanted him to, but he self-sabotaged himself, yet
there was a sadness,
this genius, mm-hmm, you know. And it's like, I think that he didn't have the straw savviness like he had his scientific savviness. I don't know how to put it into words, but
he wasn't politically skilled.
Correct.
And so it unfortunately got the better of him in the end. It was a sadness that, you know, there was something, an umbrella of sadness kind of fell over him in terms of trying to save himself, I think.
Yes. And I think one of the majority of the things I think about is how, potentially I don't wish him to be any other way, but
he could have saved the world.
Could he have better prepared the US government and set them up for what needed to be in place for then the impending arms race? And I think there was a couple specific scene. I love the scene between he and Matt Damon when Matt came to recruit, mm-hmm, him, and you saw that cheekiness, his sense of humor, but also, Kenneth Branagh played from Europe,
Bohr.
When Bohr came to talk to him and say, and they had that very emotional scene in the lecture hall, and just came to let him know that the world is not prepared and you need to prepare the world for what. And I think that was like, I had some goosebumps, and you're kind of realizing, but it's all on Oppie's shoulder. Like, no one else is taking, like, and I think that was so much. Not only are you, anyways, we could talk on and on about this, but I think, that's why I think the movie's so successful, is you have this super dynamic character that, I mean, and I think that's what's so fascinating about Chris being fascinated about the story, going, these men thought that if they potentially pushed the button, it literally might explode, go through the
universe,
and they still did it. And I think that's Oppenheimer in a nutshell.
It's that brilliance, that genius, and that it wasn't really arrogance. I didn't think they thought ever about anything other.
Yeah,
that was their life. They were the rock stars of their time, and about to change the world. But it was their world.
Yeah,
it wasn't our world. It was Oppie who thought about that as a result.
Yeah,
and understood it more as a result. He was a walking contradiction, though. Mm-hmm. I always thought that he was, from where he came to how he moves through our story and in his life, how he moved in his life. He was a walking contradiction. The genius was always within him, and it was expressed in different ways with people who, specific people that came into his circle, or how he could express was based on what he was informed by through others, whether it was Jean Tatlock, whether it was Kitty. Women seem to inform a great deal of the different sides of him. I always felt that his passion was informed by Jean and the Gita. He knew what his, at 31 years old, he knew what his mission was, although he didn't articulate it. And it wasn't articulated until he was recruited. And then came Kitty, who had her own ambition. However, she filtered her ambition, because of the time they lived in, through Oppenheimer. I always felt that the dynamic of those two women and in influencing different parts of his psychological makeup were interesting to me, and how it was then, how he then expressed in the outward world and took on he was an iconoclastic. He was an empowered iconoclast. Is that a sentence for real? I mean, empowered iconoclast. I mean, he is definitely the agent of change without a question. He stepped into that power unknowing the consequences. And so we live it.
Yeah.
And we're living it today.
Thank you for tuning into this episode. This podcast was hosted and produced by yours truly, Jackson Vickery. But a very special thank you to Sterling Gavinsky for the theme music, and to Carly Haney for the artwork. We will see you next time.